You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
It's all cold down along the beach. The wind's whipping down the boardwalk.
So we transition from Christmas to trauma on a regular basis here on All Marine Radio. So it's not a big deal for us, although it seems crazy at times. We continue. My guest, Athena I. She's written a book called Thank You for Raping Me. And we're talking about her life. And so we're in the middle of a deployment to Iraq, the city of Fallujah. She participates in Lioness operations as a combat engineer. And so you just talked about what happened to your sister. What happens next?
There's an echo on this. When you said
shit show, you took the word right out of my brain. And I know what everybody else is thinking of too, like, holy shit, this is a straight up shit show.
Yeah.
In terms of a series of events. And you're thinking, no, this is not going to get worse. And, right, bigger than shit it does. And so,
oh, yeah, yeah.
And so,
Before, I totally forgot to ask you, but Gunnar talked to me this morning, and he told me to ask you to check your phone messages.
No, tell him to go away. Stick it on mute, okay? Tell him to hit the...
It's funny, because I didn't know him in person, but I had heard about him when I deployed. Because, I mean, gunners are like leprechauns. They're one in a million and they're hard to find. But when you do, it's like, whoa, I know who you are. So it's very interesting, talking to him now.
I like that leprechaun stuff, too. He is a leprechaun.
A common engineer is that we like leprechauns. That's our thing.
I'm glad you do, because the rest of us don't like the leprechauns. Especially him. So you have this shit show going. You're deployed, and you really want your life to go away. You'd like it to happen in some kind of military event, but your life is pegging the unbearable portion of the scale. Yes.
Yes, and the honestly, kind of like similar to how my sister really helped save my life. One of the guys in my platoon did. And I had opened up to him and told him what was going on, and he was just, like, blown away. He had absolutely no idea what I was going through. And just our friendship got me through it. It helped me get back on track, and I still didn't want to come back because I knew what I was coming back to, nothing. And just drama and, you know, more dealing with all the repercussions of reporting what he had done. So I wanted to stay out there, and I actually volunteered to stay longer, but it didn't happen. Anyways, so it was interesting leading up to me talking to this special friend of mine. I had been working at an entry checkpoint. And we stayed in this like little compound. And one day it went up in like one of the SWAT huts, where they're just like wood frame buildings, that went up in flames. And these things are just pure wood, so there's electrical fire. And there was like 15 SWAT huts that just went up in flames. And, you know, all the guys were in there sleeping because, you know, a lot of them worked nights. So the guys that were on the night shift were sleeping. And walls are caving in. Myself and a couple other guys are running in and out, making sure that everyone's out, you know, dragging people out. Rounds are going off everywhere because, you know, their ammunition was, you know, near their racks or in their wall lockers, and all this, everything was just chaos, just walls coming down, roofs caving in, just running in and out of this building trying to get people out. And, as we were putting out the fire, I had another female Marine there, and she was too afraid. So she was on the sidelines just taking pictures with my camera of just, like, you know, we found a charred dead cat. There was, like, all these melted guns everywhere. So she's just taking pictures of us putting out the fire. The guys are running around in their boots and silkies, and I ended up tying my flight suit around my waist because it was, you know, it's heat, and I was dry heating, and it was just really hot. It was like 120 plus a fire. So I did that to cool down, and I was like vomiting from the heat inhalation or the smoke inhalation and just, you know, just all that stuff. So when I get back to my unit, because they had to send me back because there was nowhere for any of us to stay because the barracks was pretty much burned down. So they sent me back to my unit early, and I was showing my pictures to my platoon sergeant, and the captain walked by. And they were just, like I said, they were just pictures of us putting out this fire. And she was just like, wow, you know, can I borrow this? So I'm like, yeah, go ahead. Like, it's just pictures. So she borrows the camera and, you know, sees all these pictures and then brings it back. And then I get called into the first sergeant's office, and I was like, yes. Finally, something good's going to happen. I'm going to get, I don't know, recognized or an award or something. And I get called in, had my rights read to me. I was like, what? She's like, we're going to charge you for conduct on becoming an NCO for taking pictures with half-naked Marines and for disobeying a direct order by wearing your flight suit improperly. Because we were supposed to, like, wear it zipped up all the way. All the time. And so I started laughing. And she's like, Corporal Hyde, you think this is funny? And I was like, yeah, actually, first sergeant, I do. And she's like, get the fuck out of my office! And, like, sent me back to my room. And they wouldn't let me leave the wire, and that's all I wanted to do. I just wanted to leave. I just wanted to get out of there. And I would have rather slept in a hole than have been where with the unit I was with. Because as soon as you walk out the door, literally, I don't know, like 5-6 doors down was the CO, and then the next hallway was our entire battalion command, like XO, colonel, like all of them. And it was, as soon as you walk out that door, it doesn't matter if it's like 2-3 in the morning and you have been holding your piss in all night, you have to have your hair up in a bun, your shirt has to be tucked in, you have to have your weapon. And that's a lot to deal with when you're, like, sprinting to go to the bathroom that's, like, I don't know, like, 2 blocks away. So I just hated it. I just wanted to do my job and not worry about the stupid stuff, like what my bun looked like or if my shirt was tucked in or not. So anyways, kind of went off on a tangent there. But the first sergeant at the checkpoint that I had worked at prior to the whole place burning down, the guys that were doing construction on the entry checkpoint plowed down the search hut, so they destroyed it. So when I got there for my mission, the first sergeant was like, hey, we don't have any work for you because the jackasses out there, HE destroyed your search hut, so we couldn't search the women because there was no cover.
Right.
I was like, well, first sergeant, do you have wood? He's like, yeah, we got an ISO container of wood. It's like, why? I was like, well, I'm a combat engineer, first sergeant. That's what I do. I build things. He's like, no shit, really? I was like, yeah. So I spent the entire day prefabbing a search hut, and then he got me a couple guys the next day to put up a new one at the checkpoint. So he loved me. He always asked to bring, you know, he always asked for me to come back. So when he found out that they were trying to NJP me and take my rank, he took a convoy, and it was awesome. Like, I was standing in the hall waiting to get, you know, to find out news what was going to happen to me. And I saw him walk in to the CO's office and just lit her ass up. It was the best thing ever. And then he walked over to the first sergeant's office and did the same to her. And then when he came out, walks over, he's like, I got you. I was like, thank you so much. And he's like, don't thank me. You did your fucking job and I'm doing mine. Your command failed you. And then he just left. And they didn't bring it up again. So they dropped all the charges.
All right. So then what?
And then just more missions, you know, constantly going out and then meeting my friend, or not meeting him, just becoming a lot closer. I'd always been really good friends with him, but we bonded a lot on that deployment. So then we demilled Fallujah, actually. We were in charge of that, as the combat engineers. We just demilled that, and then we moved to Ramadi.
Explain what demilled mean.
Basically, what, you know, it would be similar to what we do in war is we go in, we take over a facility, and then we leave. And you try and leave nothing behind. So we had to ship all of our, you know, tools, everything that, you know, was worth anything, we had to ship back. The other stuff we just got to destroy, which is kind of fun. We just got to smash and burn and all sorts of destroying things.
fun stuff.
Oh, yeah. So then we just kind of destroyed anything that could be used against us, or we saved everything and then just sent it back or to wherever it was going. So then we moved to Ramadi, and that's where I kind of ended my deployment. Ramadi was boring. There was no lioness missions out there, so it was just kind of like a lot of construction and gym time. Yeah.
You know, it's just, for those of us that were there earlier, hearing the words Ramadi was boring are like unfathomable.
It was the
heart of darkness in years previous to that. So, no, and that's how, actually, that's how it stays until ISIS moves in, and then there's another chapter written. So at what point do you guys, is that the end of the significant events for the deployment?
Yes. I mean, when I say boring, I mean I wasn't allowed outside the wire.
We
fell asleep to, like, you know, 240 fire all the time, hearing RPGs coming in. Like, you would just lay, I would just be laying in my tent, and you'd hear that whistle, and I would just lay there and be like, all right, well, if it's my time to go, it's my time to go. And then you'd wait, okay, you hear it explode, wait for screams, no more screams. Okay, I guess they don't need me. You go back to bed. But, so that was... there wasn't really much that happened in Ramadi other than just my friendship with him grew even more because we spent a lot more time together. And then when I got back, just leaving to go home to his family and then, you know, having to deal with nobody to deal, you know, like all that pain and emotion I was going through. Now, I mean, before when I was deployed, I had people around me all the time.
Right.
And he was there, and then just to an empty barracks. And it's one of the most lonely feelings I've ever felt in my life. And it was really hard to deal with. But instead of becoming an alcoholic or, you know, drowning my sorrows or eating or whatever, I pursued school. I went to night school.
All right, so you're back at Camp Pendleton.
Yes.
All right, and you're and now you're a corporal, and it's the fall of 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so life resumes. Talk to us about you know what happens relative to your sister. So you obviously come home to that. And mm-hmm. you're kind of going through what, you know, the dislocation where your tribe, you're no longer with your tribe, and the loneliness that you're describing. Talk to us about that. And then when do you get out of the Marine Corps, Athena?
I got out in 2010, but 2010. I think one of the biggest things that is missing from people being able to understand fully what I went through was that there was, I didn't feel there was a tribe. I, you know, the only time I actually felt like I was part of the group was when I was with the grunts.
Right.
They treated me like an equal. My guys treated me just like a pair of tits walking around. And it didn't matter how hard I worked. I was one of the only females that made it up the mountain in Bridgeport. I held my own. They never had to help me carry my pack. They never had to get behind me and push me up a hill like I actually did for other guys. You know, they, nothing was enough for them. It didn't matter what I did or, you know, how I held myself. I would never be a Marine to them. I would just be a female Marine. And before I deployed, I had actually been drugged and raped twice by Marines. And the first time was in E-School, Engineer Combat School. And I don't even know who the guy was. They drugged me, and I woke up in a hotel room to him raping me. And I just fled. I just got out of there as soon as I could. And by the time I got back, this was off base. And by the time I got back on base, it's amazing how rumors fly. Like less than, 8 hours, and I walk through the chow hall and I hear people, oh, that's the whore that hooked up with, you know, blah, blah, blah. Oh, here's another walking mattress. And I was like, oh my God. Yeah. So it was not easy. And then when I got to, and I was still a virgin. Well, when I say a virgin, I mean I had not chosen to sleep with anyone at that point. Like I hadn't had consensual sex yet. So, you know, to be raped twice before you even choose to sleep with someone, it's not easy to get over. And especially if one of the guys in my unit was in the room. He had watched the whole thing happen. Yeah. So
the first one happens at engineer school.
Yes.
When's the second one happen?
I was active duty, and I had met a guy and was dating him and actually had consensual sex with him. And I think I did it just so I could get it over with and just finally be able to control who I did sleep with. And I wasn't in love with them or anything, but it was more of a filler relationship, I guess. And it was trying to move on, and he had, let's see, what was the detail? Oh, so he was out one evening when I found out my grandfather had died, and I went over to a good friend of mine's room, and his other friend, who was like my little brother, we had gone through training together, school together, all of that. So the three of us were very close, and I really considered them brothers. And I walked, you know, went over to their room, and I was like, hey, you guys, you know, just didn't want to be alone. So I had one drink. It was like I think it was a shot of Jaeger. Mm-hmm. And that was it. And I, at that point, I mean, I could hang with the guys. I could drink and handle my own. And I had one shot, and I woke up, and my friend was taking off my clothes and had his finger all in there. And, I woke up, and he had raped me. And I had ended up calling my boyfriend that night somehow, and he wasn't answering his phone. So then the next day, that day when I woke up and I realized what had happened, found out, I don't know if it was that day or the next. I think it was the next day, but my boyfriend at the time ended up having an orgy the same night that I was raped. And how it happened was they had two other girls in the room, and there was like three guys. And there was another guy that was outside trying to get into the barracks room to join in. And they wouldn't let him in. So he called PMO and said they were raping the girls. So PMO shows up, the girls are like, no, they raped us, blah, you know, that whole card. And the idiots took pictures and videos. So an NCIS investigated, it was found out that it was consensual, and these girls were just too afraid of ruining their reputation, which is just stupid because they slept with the entire, like, barracks already. And because of that, we had, like, rape watch on every floor, on every corner. And that's a lot of, like, 24-hour. So now instead of our free time, now we're on rape watch. And everyone was pissed. I mean, there's like an entire barracks, I don't know, like maybe a couple hundred Marines. And there are maybe the five females in the building. And all of them are pissed. So I can't imagine, like, I was just like, there's no way anyone would believe me, especially after this happened. And then you'd have to face all that drama. So I just took it into my own hands, and I dealt with it in my own way. Threatened his life to cut off his balls and shove them down his throat if he ever came near me again. He never did, so. But just going forward with a platoon, one of them already raped you, two of them had already known about it and possibly been involved with it, and deploying with these guys. And then another situation, this is how my guys treated me. I was, I had a one guy that I knew he liked me, but he was just this big country bumpkin that I had no, like, he was probably like, I don't know, 6'2", good 220 pounds. And I found out that, like, from my guys, they just like to tell me things. They're like, oh, yes, you know, so-and-so said he was going to do this, stick all these things up in you, and, like, all these horrible, disgusting, like, sexual things. And they thought it was hilarious. And so when I deployed, we were out at this little fob, and, you know, we didn't have a porta potty within. You'd have to walk like 2 miles to go take a piss. There was no showers, nothing. So I was out there in the middle of nowhere I was the only girl. And they thought it was hilarious to put me on night watch with this guy, just me and him. But thankfully, I had a loaded gun at that time, and we weren't able to drink. So I didn't have, you know, they weren't going to drug me this time. I'd shoot them. But just going, you know, going forward with that and knowing that no one had my, like, maybe one or two of them. Yeah, there were some good guys in the group. Like, the friend I mentioned, he saved my life, and they weren't all bad. They weren't. And I don't blame the Marine Corps. I blame the individual.
All right, so now we're... No. It's fine.
Another bomb just got dropped.
I'm trying to make sense of this. So you come home to all of this in the fall of 2008. And so did you not, you don't reenlist, you get out in 2010. Why did you not stay in the Marine Corps?
Oh, God, that's another bad story. I feel like there's just one bad story after the other. And I don't want to give too much away out of the book. You know, it's just basically spoiler alert. I should have said that at the beginning. But, no, there was a lot more behind it, but make a long story short, I was forced out because of tattoos.
Okay.
And and some other stuff happened as well. But
you can read about it in the book.
Yeah. I used that to motivate me to finish school. I graduated. I got my bachelor's degree. Like, a month after I left the Marine Corps, I graduated. Because I've been going to school full time at night.
Okay.
So I was doing night school. And when I got out, I finished my bachelor's, and then I went and got my master's in forensics. And I studied pedophiles. And I studied rapists. Because I wanted to understand.
Right.
Because in order for me to be able to deal with my trauma, I needed to comprehend it and understand it to get over it. So that's the route I took. Went from there and pursued my PhD. So I'm going to be a doctor soon. I'm going to have a doctorate in forensic psychology. Research, not clinical-based. I wanted to be able to study people, not necessarily, interact with them as much. Because I, as a psychologist, I was starting to do family therapy in order so I could be able to treat veterans and actually provide them with therapy that they could relate to, because all the psychologists that I had seen prior to that point had never, they had never seen combat. They had absolutely no idea. They had never been raped. They couldn't relate. So it was, I felt a responsibility to be able to help these people out because I had already been through all that. So I kind of, it was kind of like a been there, done that type thing, and you can give your way of how you coped with it and got over it, which I find is so much more beneficial than giving you, you know, all these facts as you learned in school. And I had always, I had learned from my previous professors, the ones that had the biggest impact were the ones that actually were talking about something that they had experienced. So I had a teacher that was a former CIA and another one that was actually interviewed prisoners. And I appreciated those people more than just someone that had a degree that, oh, I went to school. It's kind of like with you went to school, but you never did the job. You'd never been there. You just, you only know what you were taught, not I know because I've been through it. So I was doing that for, I did that, and then I got to clinicals, and I had this girl crying and saying that she was suicidal because her cat died. And I couldn't deal with it. I wanted to slap her. And I was like, this isn't going to be healthy for me or for them because I won't be able to help them. And it would just make me angry. So I had to step away from that and just go to research and to, so more research based. So that's kind of why I took that route. Went and traveled the world, been to 39 countries so far, ended up living in Thailand for a couple years, which was awesome. It was amazing. Traveling really is therapeutic. And especially if you're a combat veteran and you have that void that you can't find or fill with that, you know, that action and that adrenaline and that just not knowing what's going to happen, go travel. It's amazing. It's amazing what it can do. It really helped.
Talk to us about when does the idea begin to percolate about writing a book?
In Thailand. I met a very good friend of mine. I met him there. He does a lot of boot camp training, and that's kind of how we got involved. And he's also a director, a movie director. And I had shared some of my stories with him. He's like, you need to write this shit down. He's like, I would love to turn this into a movie. He's like, it'd be like my ultimate, like, life project. So I did. I in Thailand, I just got my computer out and started writing. So it took me a long time, about 3 years. And it's not that it takes that long to write it. It's more of the editing that took that was really hard for me because writing that book was brutal. There's stuff in there that I never even wrote in my like journals because to me I wasn't ready to write it down yet because once you write it down there's no going back. And I wasn't prepared to even mentally admit things that I had been through in my life, and so writing that book was so therapeutic. And unbelievable. It's like opening a wound that has been, that you have covered up and hasn't, you didn't clean it out enough. So you didn't sterilize it to the point where it could properly heal. It is, you know, it's just been covered up for years. So I finally reopened it, bleached the shit out of it, and then slowly start to recover after it.
What have you learned in the writing as you've done your doctoral research, as you've written, what have you learned about trauma?
There's so many different things. I think the number one would be you can't really completely heal until you're honest with yourself. You can't. You can cope with it and you can cover it up in order to be able to get through to the next point. Yes, there are so many. I think what people don't realize is you do need that period and that time to feel and to cry and to be angry. And a lot of times that won't happen until you're ready. So what you do before then is you just block it all off. You become numb. And a lot of times people never get to that second phase is dealing with it.
Right.
So they shut themselves off, and then they never deal with it. And then there's, you know, it's just, it's eating them alive from the inside out.
You know, a group used to meet after I would see my therapist in Los Angeles. And they were all Vietnam veterans. And when I'd park my truck outside, I'd walk in and they'd be outside. Because they would do their thing right before I got there. They were from 12 to 1, and I got there at 1. And so I'd say hi to these guys and, you know, talk to them for a few minutes before I walked inside. And they were all great guys. And so one day I asked, I said, hey, what do you, you know, all these years later, what do you talk to these Vietnam veterans about? And he looked at me and said, the same shit I talk to you about. I said, I mean, all these years later? And he looked at me and said, they've never dealt with it.
Yeah.
And I said, they stuck Vietnam in the closet? He said, yep.
Yep.
And that's where it's been. And now they're retiring, and they have more time to think, and it's seeping out. And that has been an effective way for people to deal with it, which is just stuff it in the corner, stuff it in the closet, lock the door, and do not go near the doorknob.
Yep. And a lot of times what will bring that out is either hearing someone's story that is so like yours, it's like you relive it. And that's what opens up a lot of wounds. And sometimes it gets to that point where they're finally, they open the door and they see their problem, and now they're ready to deal with it. Before, they couldn't. They weren't mentally prepared for it. And you can't really force someone to get to that point. All you can do is provide someone that's not going to judge them, and someone that will just listen and support them, and not, you know, be like, oh, I don't believe you. And that's a big fear of a lot of people, is that they won't be believed.
And you know what? And we're all guilty of it, right? You were just guilty of it a few minutes ago. This girl who thinks that her cat dying, I want to snap her neck, right? I mean,
yeah.
And we as Marines, you know, and I'm embarrassed to say it, I called the guy who's now a good friend of mine, I called him a pussy on the show. Like, hey, man, you sound like a pussy. You're a rich kid, and all of a sudden you have everything that God could give somebody, and all of a sudden your life's in the shitter, and you're bitching about it?
Mm-hmm.
But what I, you know, and I'd like your thoughts on this. You know, we can play whose dick is bigger with trauma, okay? But at the end of the day, all trauma affects us all the same, right? Her cat, as stupid as it may sound to us who've lived different lives, fractured her and scarred her deeply. Now, us sitting there, it takes every ounce of discipline in your body to bite your tongue and to grip the arms rest on the chair and say, get the hell out of here.
Mm-hmm.
But that trauma affected that person deeply. And so to me, I've seen it with my sister. And my sister, who, you know, her two sons were both shot in the head by her husband, who then killed himself.
Yeah.
And so I've always had bifocals relative to trauma. Yeah, you know, what we've seen here in Iraq is really shitty.
Yeah.
But let me introduce you to my sister.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And I can take you to shittier. So,
yeah.
You know, it really doesn't matter how you acquired this traumatic event into your head. What we have to do is, what you're talking about is being accepting. And that's not easy for everybody to do.
No, it's not.
Your thoughts on that?
Well, that's why I took myself out of that situation.
Right.
I knew I was not going to be what they needed. And knowing yourself and seeking self-improvement, right? You know, that's where I was like, I know myself. I can't work with these people. It's not going to benefit anybody.
Right.
And I get what you're saying, that trauma is trauma, but I do have to disagree with you because, okay, so I was trying to think of how to put it into an explanation. It would be like a hurricane, okay? You went through a hurricane. Okay, but what category did you go through? That's going to be a very different experience. And that traumatic event that one person went through, the category one, is going to be completely different to the highest category, or I don't know all the different categories of hurricanes, but that's kind of how I view it. That's kind of how I view trauma. Or like, imagine trauma is a stab wound. Okay? There's all sorts of different stab wounds. Some stab wounds are going to be like, oh, you got 3 stitches, you're good to go, see you later, have a great day. Other stab wounds are going to end up in a 14-hour surgery on life support, critical condition, all that kind of stuff. So there are different levels of trauma. And in order to be able to, a lot of those are going to require different types of recovery. Some are going to take years to get over. Some are going to take a quick, hey, let's take those stitches out. You're good to go. You got a scar. Sucks. But, hey, let's keep moving. And then you have the trauma that is so obvious, and you try and hide it up. You are afraid for others to see it. So you cover that trauma up. You cover that scar up. You don't want anyone to see it. And you get to a certain point where you're just like, fuck it. Here's my scar, guys. This is how it happened. I'm still me. Don't feel sorry for me. Don't stare at me. Don't pity me. Yeah, I got stabbed pretty bad. There's a massive scar on my arm now. But I got over it, moved on.
Yeah, but, you know, that's you sitting in judgment of somebody else's trauma. And I think that's wrong. And I'll give you an example here in the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps is going to set a record for suicide this year. And 90% of them have never heard a shot fired in anger.
I know. I agree.
So their trauma is not legitimate in the eyes of a lot of guys like me. Like, what the fuck, man? They've never even seen, you know, they haven't seen shit. What are they killing themselves for?
Yeah, but then at that...
I don't know. So I guess you have to ask them what's so traumatic in their life that you don't think is significant that they're killing themselves for.
Oh, I didn't say it wasn't significant. I'm saying, like, don't judge a book by its cover because we have no idea what they went through before that. So what if that person had, you know, seen his dad brutally murdered, had done this, done that? Yeah, he might not have gone to combat, but he did go through all of that, and then all of a sudden you finally find family in the military, and then you get, you know, then you get out and you have nothing. And you just sink into this black hole that's caving in on you, and you feel like you're drowning. And I'm not saying that, you know, someone's cat dying doesn't warrant therapy. I'm just saying they are going to need different type of therapy. So you can't treat everyone the same. You can't. All trauma is different. Some trauma is going to take a lot longer to heal from because of the severity of it.
Yeah, I don't think you heal from trauma, though.
I don't think
it's laser etched into your brain, and you can seek to understand it. But I think the things that traumatize us, I don't think you heal from. You learn to coexist with them. I don't think you heal from them.
I was thinking about this last night. I think a lot of times people misinterpret trauma. And what's the difference between trauma and drama? You know, I think a lot of people try and use something that happened in their life to make excuses for their actions. And I've seen this a lot, like with false claims of rape. Oh, I got drunk, I had sex with that guy, and now I'm completely embarrassed and I don't want anyone to know, so now I'm going to say he raped me. Or you get those people that, yeah, my dad spanked me growing up, and now I blame everything on them.
Right.
All of my bad choices I blame on them. So I think there's a big, you know, and that's what's hard about it, is you can't judge somebody.
No, but I think you're right, and the road that you're going down is when you meet somebody and they do begin to open up to you, I think as a listener, one thing you have to do is you have to say, are there other mental health issues involved in this?
Absolutely.
That it's not simply somebody dealing with trauma that's a grown-up, responsible human being, but it's like, you know what, there are maturity issues, there may be issues of depression or other issues related here, and so it's not trauma with a grown-up that we can talk about and deal with it, that the majority of us under the bell curve would experience, but it is something in addition to trauma, or whatever they believe was trauma that is acting this out. No, I think that's right. I think that as a listener and as somebody who deals with people with trauma, it's almost like you're triaging them as you listen.
Absolutely.
As you listen, like, how do I help this person, and what is, you know, what is the appropriate course, you know, how do I help them, you know, get through this? Because obviously they care enough about it to unburden themselves. And
absolutely.
I would like to help them. Talk to me about, go ahead.
Well, it is. It's just like you said. It's you're doing triage. You're evaluating how severe it is. But one of the biggest things that I have learned is there's so many different levels of resilience. And it's shocking. You know, you look at these child soldiers. You look at these women that, you know, like your sister, you look at people that, or, you know, other people that have seen their kids raped and killed in front of them. Good God, I don't feel like my story comes anywhere close to that.
Oh, yeah.
But, so that's why it's, but you do, you have to evaluate the situation, and you have to take into context everything that they've been through before, and now, you know, you have to treat the whole person, not just one incident.
Right.
So.
Right. Talk to me about the effect of writing the book. So you write the book, right? You've crafted this thing, and now you're going to launch it out into the planet, right? And then God only knows what's coming back, okay? So talk to us about, since you've launched it, what's been the response, and how has it affected you?
It's been ups and downs, definitely, because with something like this, I don't hold back. I don't, you know, I did change all the names because I'm not out here trying to, you know, get political status or defend one, you know, oh, all for Trump or all for this person. I'm not doing that. I'm just sharing the truth and what happened to me. And a lot of people aren't going to like it. I've already had, and it's interesting because the negative that I've received has actually been from Marines. Now, definitely a lot of positive from them as well. They are family to me, and I've had so many reach out and just be incredibly supportive and thankful and open up and tell me their story, and it's been overwhelming. And in a lot of ways, it's that helps you get through trauma, is realizing that all the stuff you went through wasn't for vain, and it's helping people. So especially as, you know, Marines, they're very self-sacrificing. Like, they signed up to sacrifice themselves for their country. And I think that's why I hope a lot more start down the same path and just being honest and truthful and letting people know what's going on. And in turn, it is probably going to help save more lives. And knowing that I have the potential to help save people as a Marine, that's amazing. That is unbelievably therapeutic. So I implore all of you just start to be honest with yourself, and then slowly start to be honest with others.
Talk to us about the impact it has on you. I kind of describe it as kind of a Grinch moment where your story helps somebody else, like the Grinch's heart grew, right, three sizes when he heard the Who people singing. And when your story can help somebody else, talk about how that's impacted you.
Well, before I published, I was terrified, because in the book there's a lot of people that I talk about and a lot of people that are going to be very, very hurt from it. Not because of my own, you know, my actions, but because I'm sharing the truth about what happened. So my family's going to read this. My people that know my family have already read this, and they now know the truth. So I was terrified because, there is no real ever going, being part of that family again. there's no going back.
Right.
I want nothing to do with them. But
did you
my
have,
sister.
It didn't sound like you had much of a relationship except with your sister before that.
Absolutely. She's the only thing that kept me in that family. And once she denies everything. She says that she never said that. She never admitted that to happen. She says he's an incredible brother and a great dad. And that's her, you know, that's what she's saying. And I, you know, I, that hurt. Because then she reached out again, like, a while ago and was just telling me that she felt sorry for me and I needed God. And that hurt. That really, really hurt. And I knew that publishing this book might close any door I ever have of getting her back.
Right.
So to share this story and risk so much, it was terrifying. And I knew that there was going to be backlash. I knew, especially with one person, I knew it was going to really rock that boat and test our relationship, which it has. He didn't talk to me for a while, and that hurt, but at the same time, I understood it because, you know, now they have to deal with the truth and other people knowing the truth, and that isn't easy. Not a lot of people just want to keep it buried and never bring it up again. And I just opened up a lot of raw wounds. You know, I opened it up and poured salt in it.
Right.
And there's a lot of angry people. You know, I get the comments that I'm lying. I'm trying to be a victim and ask for attention and get money from it. I'm like, no, I don't like sharing in details about my brother raping me. That's not fun. That's unbelievably painful. And then to have people question it on top of it and call me a liar and all sorts of other names, it's not easy. And I knew that was coming. But you can't, like I said before, you can't prepare for it completely. There are going to be days that are really hard, and you just have to deal with it. And a lot of the people that I've reached out and been supportive, I've had around 12 guys reach out and tell me about their story, about, you know, what happened to them. And it's not just women. It's happening to men even so much more than we know about, because, well, most of them, these 12 guys, I think only two of them reported it. So there's 10 people that are not getting help. They aren't talking about it. And now that they finally, you know, told somebody, hopefully they can find other people. And that's why I was, you know, I asked them if they wanted to share their story anonymously to show other people that, hey guys, it doesn't just happen to women. It happens to men as well, a lot more often than we think. And I think it will help other people that have gone through it too. So I had one female Marine reach out to me. She's like, I didn't know anyone had ever gone through this. I didn't know this was a thing. A family member had raped her when she was little. She didn't tell anyone. So I, you know, shared my story with her, and she was just, she broke down and she went in the room and told her husband. She, you know, similar, she just said she could finally breathe again.
That she had been raped.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike shared with you, I'm sure, his story about,
yes,
a similar situation.
Mm-hmm.
For a lot of people, it's unfathomable that somebody that you love couldn't come to you and tell you that. And so that's why these stories are so powerful. What, mm-hmm, in the last almost 2 hours, what haven't I been smart enough to ask you about your book, about your experience that you want people to know, Athena?
I wouldn't say smart enough. We're just having a conversation.
That was a trick question. That was the right answer. What haven't I asked you?
I don't think it's necessarily what you haven't asked me. What I would like to do is just, the reason I wrote this, you guys, is, yes, I did have a really shitty life. And I asked one of my friends, was like, how do I, like, write this book when I'm homeless? At the time, like, I had asked him, and I was homeless. And I was like, I'm homeless. I don't have a job. I'm about to have, you know, surgery that I don't want to have. I had a hysterectomy for some health issues. And I was like, I'm about to lose everything. All I wanted to do was have a kid that would be a family of my own that, you know, would love me and I would love and have at least one person in my life that wasn't going to leave me or just, you know, that's how I kind of viewed it. And I was like, how am I going to motivate people and give them hope to keep going when most people would read this book and, like, want to go kill themselves afterwards? Like, I was like, how do I end this? And he's like, nope, just keep writing. Just do it. Publish it now. And, you know, life is hard. I hate all those movies out there that end with this unrealistic happily ever after. That's not life. Life is about dealing with what is given to you and not letting it stop you. So I could have absolutely turned into a whore, got knocked up when I was a child or whatever, ended up in prison. I could have taken all of those easy routes out and just let go. But I chose not to, and I chose to use that pain that I had been through to motivate me. You know, there's a lot of people that I admire that lost a limb or, you know, in an accident or in some kind of trauma, and they don't give up, and they end up using that, you know, yeah, I don't have a leg, but guess what? Look what I can do now. And they use it to fuel them to go climb mountains, go, you know, onto a rowing competition, go to whatever, unbelievable things that they would have never been able to do before because they didn't have that traumatic event that kicked them in the ass and says, don't give up. Like, yes, life just dealt you a shitty hand. In fact, I kind of feel like Loki in, like, the Avengers, and the Hulk gets them and just smashes the shit out of them, and then he stops, and then you get that, like, moment where you're like, okay, is it done? Is it over? Nope. Then he keeps on going.
I'm sure it comes again.
Yeah. Those are hard to get up from, but what you don't realize is that I'm grateful for those moments because it helped me realize that, yeah, my ass just got handed to me. I just got face planted, and it took me a while to get back up. But guess what? I got through that. Now I can get through absolutely anything life has to throw at me. And I use it to...
Is that the message of the book?
Yes, that you can find... Use your trauma to inspire you to do things that you could have never done before.
Why did you pick that title? Because it certainly... You read it and you're like, what?
Yeah.
Thank you for raping me. Why did you pick that title?
I picked it because... When people have asked me, like, is there anything in your life you would go back to and change? And I say no. And they're like, wait, you got raped 3 times. Why wouldn't you go and change that? Because it made me who I am today. And I look in the mirror, and I am so proud of who I've become and what I've done. And just, it's almost like working for something so hard. Instead of just being handed, that work and that effort that you put in is so much more rewarding than just, oh, hey, you know, it would be similar to, like, the Marine Corps, like, oh, you just hand out that Eagle Golden Anchor to anyone. It wouldn't mean anything. You had to work really hard to get to where you were, and it means the world to me. So that's why I chose that title, and it's just to take back the power that they tried to take from me. They tried to break me. They tried to turn me into a shellless creature, empty creature.
And they, as in life?
In people.
Okay. All the people.
And those people, that raped me, okay. They tried to take it from me. And this is my way of saying, fuck you. You tried, and guess what? You just made me stronger.
I have some email questions for you.
Okay.
Hi, Mac. How did she get to the point in her life that she was able to talk about her rape? You know my story, but other than you, there is only one person in this world that knows what happened to me in my teens. Although I've learned to deal with it and I have lived a full life, I still can't find myself to come out about what happened, and I don't know if I ever will. I admire her courage for talking about this. How'd you get to the point in your life to be able to talk about it?
The first time I told anyone about being raped as a child was my ex-boyfriend the day he broke up with me. It was my first boyfriend. And he broke up with me, and I ended up telling him. And I think it was just because I had never felt that much of a heartbreak, and it was just like the floodgates opened, and I needed to tell somebody. It was like I couldn't hold it in any longer. But, you know, a lot of times that's what happens. Something will happen in your life that will trigger you to be able to, you know, just open up and tell somebody. And that's the first step. The other, it took me a long time. It took me years to be able to accept it, deal with it on my own. And then I think a lot of it has to do with fear. Fear of not being understood or not being believed, or the, you know, people making fun of you. That happens.
Right.
You know, just the embarrassment that would follow.
Right.
And for me, I face my fears. Whatever I'm afraid of, I go and I'm just like, okay, bring it on. Like, I was afraid of traveling by myself and I moved to Thailand. I was afraid of I'm afraid of heights, so I went skydiving. I'm afraid of a lot of things, and I just face them because I don't want anything controlling my life other than me. It's up to me to how to deal with all this stuff that's thrown at me. There is no one else to blame but myself. My outcome in life is on me. At the end of the day, I'm responsible for my own life, not others. So once you can deal with that and accept that, it's a fearful thing. But what I do hope others see out there is that once you do and you start to share, you're going to be amazed by how many people are going to do the same thing. So it's like a domino effect. Hey, this is what happened to me, guys. And this isn't about reporting. This isn't about coming forward and trying to get somebody in trouble. It's admitting with yourself, finally, about the truth. And once that, you know, once that first domino goes, it's a domino effect. It's just, you know, hey, thank you for sharing that. Guess what? Here's my story. And then, oh, I'm going to go share it with this person because, hey, you helped me. So it's amazing what sharing your story and other responses will do to get you to share it even more.
So. Interesting. The power of the people that you affect, I think, is so uplifting. But as Athena said, there's a downside too. You are going to get people that take you to task, and especially with the way social media is now, and all of that garbage. And so there's that sword has two edges to it.
Yeah.
But I think the upside certainly outweighs the downside. But I will tell you this, that fear is real because you're not really sure. You might not be sure what somebody's going to do, and you don't want to lose that person from your life. So I completely understand people that don't want to go there. I think it's sad, but I understand that. Here's another one. I'm sitting here in awe, speechless, not worthy. Bridgeport, Fallujah, Michigan. Well, I don't know if Michigan is that bad.
It is.
Yeah, don't kid yourself. I can't wait to share this podcast with a close friend of mine, non-USMC, that experienced a similar trauma when she was 12. Athena, thank you, and Semper Fi. You know, Athena, one of the coolest things that I've discovered, and I think Mike and I have discovered together, is you know, in the Marine Corps, we do talk about trauma a little bit. We're not very good at it, but we talk about it. In the civilian world, you talk about trauma when you go see a therapist. And I don't know that therapists help more than they hurt. I think it might be a 50-50 bag at best. But we who seek to live purpose-driven lives, when we can use our knowledge about trauma and hopefully a little bit of the wisdom that we've gained by listening to people like you and other people who come on this program to talk about it, when you can touch somebody else's life and ease their burden, That is such an incredible, uplifting experience, and to non-military people. And I think there's a huge mission for all veterans. If you can get your hands and learn and understand about trauma, that you can on a daily basis or on a weekly basis affect people's lives, because there's so much of this shit out there.
Yeah.
And it's very cool. And obviously, you're making an impact in somebody's life. Let me read you two more. It has been a riveting conversation this morning. I could listen to her and her stories for quite a long time. God bless her. Here's another one. Today's show. Jesus, unbelievable. Thank you, and thank you. Thank her especially. So, Athena, thank you very much. Tell people where they get your book.
It is available on any online platform that sells books, so Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I'm trying to get it into other stores right now, but just let everybody know, I'm a self-publisher. The publishing houses wouldn't come near this title. they try to get me to... I'm very... And just a warning for those that have been raped and have been through trauma like that, it's extremely... It's a very difficult read. There's a lot... It's an emotional roller coaster, and... Just a fair warning, I'm extremely graphic in detail. I had, you know, a couple editors were like, you cannot write this. This is like, a graphic rape scene. And you're like, you need to water it down, because there's some people that are going to have to put the book down and not be able to read it. And I said, no, because I'm so sick and tired of people watering down and sugarcoating rape and other trauma. They need to know the truth about what this does to people. And so I've made a lot of errors. There might be, you know, a couple spelling errors in the book. That bugs me, but hey, I'm a self-publisher. I did it my own, you know, on my own. I had to learn, you know, 12 different jobs from.
Hold on. Let me tell you, if you read that book and that's what you come away with, you're an asshole, okay? You have the time to bust off an email that you misspelled the word together on page 143. You're a dick.
Oh, yeah, I know. I'm expecting that already, because there's just some people, you can never make them happy. And that's fine. But I'm open for suggestions and so that's why it's not, I haven't done any, you know, I haven't been on the news yet. I would like to do a book tour, but I'm unemployed right now. I'm a college student, so I'm kind of broke. And in order to travel and do a book tour, it takes money. So the more people that buy the book, hopefully the more people I can reach. And that's what it's all about. You know, people accuse me of trying to make money off of traumatic, my being raped. And I just laughed, and I was like, okay. You know that most authors in their lifetime will make maybe 5,000, you know, sales of their book, which isn't, you know, that might be $5,000 to $10,000. You can't live off of that. So there is
isn't
about making money for me.
It's really about
surviving.
It's really hard to live off $5,000 to $10,000. So ask anybody who's tried. Here's another email. Athena, an amazing journey. Thank you 100 times over. Athena, I hope this will be the first of a number of times that you come back. I know that I should have you, Mike, and I should kind of round table some stuff. So we'll plan on doing that. But first of all, thank you very much for coming on and doing this. Congratulations on your Marine Corps career. Obviously, has taken you to a better place in life. And I'll tell you, the book, people need to know that trauma's out there. But most importantly, as you said, right, this is not going to stop me. This is not going to, you know, going to finish me. And
no.
I've, you know, Mike recommended, Mike one night watched the movie that Elizabeth Smart made, right? And if there's ever a girl that has every ticket punched, much like my sister, that has every ticket punched to be a dysfunctional, you know, human being, and we would all like say, oh, well, you know, that's Elizabeth Smart, of course. She didn't take that. Right.
Yeah.
She's Elizabeth Smart is a vibrant woman. And, you know, at the age of 14, being raped almost every night for 10 months. Hello?
Yeah.
Really? And so, you know, you're in that class of human beings. So thank you very much for coming on here and sharing your story. Wish you all the best of luck with your book and your ongoing college studies.
And let us know when they have the big ceremony, and we'll come down.
Awesome. And I just want to let all the Marine listeners know, I don't blame the Marine Corps. I don't hold the Marine Corps responsible. I love my Marines. My Marines are my family, and I would die for all of you guys. And I
okay,
think just
maybe
being able to love
not,
guys.
Maybe not all of them.
Yeah.
Most of them. Most of them.
I wouldn't piss on if they're burning.
Exactly. No, you know what? I mean, like us, it's our tribe. It's how we identify ourselves in a huge chunk of our lives. And as you said, you know, it's we choose it because we look for people like us, look for challenges and want to make a difference. And we choose it because it's not easy. And as a result, it leaves a dent and a few, and it's seared into our brains as well. So no, and let me just tell you, if you can take any part of this interview that Athena doesn't love the Marine Corps, then I don't think you're paying attention. So I hear what you're saying, though. So again, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
All right, now we'll do it again.
Awesome.
There you have it. Athena Ives here on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio. Mike, when he called me, he said, you know, hey, this is an incredibly powerful story. You need to have her on. And he was right. He's not right often, but he's right about that. All right, if you're just joining us, don't touch that dial. You'll hear Athena's interview in its entirety. You'll hear the news hour, where we'll talk about building the wall, Nancy Pelosi's comments about the president's manhood, right, less than a week after we were talking about President Bush, the way he conducted himself, and why can't we do that? So we'll talk about that a little bit in the first hour. So, and can the president actually use DOD funding to build the wall? Can he do that? I don't think he can. On a Wednesday, my thanks to Athena Ives. All Marine Radio, over and out.